You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation, brought to you by Exodus Trail Cameras. Now, if you guys aren't familiar with Exodus Trail Cameras, I'm going to recommend you go to their website. Tons of great information about their products, right? The cool part is they're turning four. They're having their fourth anniversary. And to celebrate, they are offering 25% off their Exodus Lift 2, their Trek, and their new solar panel. And this is running from May 15th to May 28th. They have a ton of great features, right? I don't have enough time to share all of those features in this little time frame that I have to talk about it. But here's what I'm going to tell you. I have a camera off their very first run, and it has not given me any problems at all, right? Put the SD card in, format the card, turn it on, and it takes pictures, period, right? And that's what we want trail cameras to do. They work every single time. Take advantage of this. 25% off. Go to their website, exodusoutdoorgear.com. Do some research about all the functionality of their cameras, right? You can take a look at their price. You can find the one that's right for you. You can enter the discount code YEAR4, Y-E-A-R, the number 4, and save 25%. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and one of my favorite things about hosting this podcast is I get the ability to talk with some very interesting people, some very good people, the best of the best in the hunting community, and that's who I get to talk to today. I get to talk with a guy named Alex Gilstrom. He works for Whitetail Properties. He's their director of marketing, or he does something in the marketing department, and he's just a good guy, and he's very passionate about the outdoors, and he's passionate about bow hunting, and that is what we talk about today. We talk about his love and his passion for the outdoors. We talk about how he kind of got into the hunting industry at a very early age, and I mean like 14, he was calling companies saying, hey, are you looking for an internship? And people were saying, hey man, you're only 14 years old, why don't you give it a couple years, right? So that's how passionate he was about wanting to work in the hunting industry. That's how passionate he was about bow hunting and just hunting in general. And that's what this podcast is about, man. We talk about, you know, his dad being in, you know, a big influence in his life when it comes to hunting. We talk about, you know, how he got into the industry and what led him to the position that he's at today with Whitetail Properties, and a whole bunch of other stuff. The big thing that I like talking about with everybody on this podcast, and it's kind of a main theme with everybody that I interview, is we tend to talk about how failure turns to success, right? How if the first time something doesn't work out, you try it again and it works out, right? Or you keep trying and you fail and you fail and you fail and you keep out. And guess what? That worked for him, not only on the hunting side, but on his career side as well, right? He wanted to be in the hunting industry because that was his passion. And he kept calling people and calling people, and finally it paid off, right? And you're going to hear the whole story on today's episode. It's a straight up BS session, so it's a really good laid back episode. But before we get into today's episode, I always like talking about this partner of the podcast. It's Ripcord Arrow Rests, right? It's just a badass company. I know the owner, right? And when you know the owner of a company is just as passionate about bow hunting and hunting in general as you are, that gets me excited about their product line, right? They have one of the best drop away rests on the market, period. It's made in America. It's a veteran-owned company. And it's not only a badass product, but the whole team of people that work there, I've got the opportunity to meet a couple of them at some of these trade shows. They're very good people. You call them up, they'll answer your question. If you have a problem, they will solve your problem. And that right there, customer service on top of a product that is durable and reliable, is top notch in my book, right? So they have a limb driven system, they have a string driven system, and they have like five or six different rests that you can choose from, whether you want to do some micro tuning or if you want something that just straight up works every single time. And their rests work every single time. I beat the shit out of my equipment every single year, and I have yet to ever have a problem. And I'm talking 10 years of usage with their rest. So go check out their rest, ripcordaerorest.com, and take a look at everything that they have to offer. There's that. Let's get into today's BS Session podcast with Alex Gilstrom. Mr. Alex Gilstrom, how you doing, man?
Doing well, buddy. Doing well.
You kill any turkeys this year?
I tell you, yeah, we did. You know, I was just talking to a guy, a buddy of mine, about trying to figure out what the total number was. I think I've seen 8 die this year, and I've killed 2 myself, but it has not been without a lot of hard work. It seems like everyone that we've got on and worked, it's been just a scratching tooth and nail to get the thing killed. But it's been fun though. We enjoy the struggle as much as the easy ones too. So it's been a good spring. How about you?
Well, I tell you what, we got lucky right off the roost with my wife, and then like you had to, you know, grind, and then the time frame for us came to an end, and I ended up not getting one, which is no problem to me. I'm not like a crazy turkey hunter by any means, and I've killed a lot of them in my life already. So like turkey hunting for me is kind of extra. I try to go out and get my wife one. But this year has been an odd year. From like, I got some spots where I'll take my wife because it's easy. There's always a bird roosted on this ridge, and then I'll hear gobbles, you know? So as soon as my wife gets one, we'll go chase a gobble down this big valley. And this year, I feel like the bird numbers were cut in half, if not more.
I agree. I mean, at the very least, the gobbling, you know, and I don't know if it was just that late winter, kind of that late cold snap we had and then finally warmed up. But yeah, I can count easily on one hand the amount of days where you're like, all right, this is, you know, it's turkey season's here, kind of a feeling.
Yeah.
And there was not many of them. But yeah, I mean, I'm a lot like you. I absolutely love to hunt them, and it's a pile of fun, but I'd almost rather just go call for somebody or take somebody else that hasn't, you know, shot a bunch of them, or maybe get their first bird or something like that. That's the fun part for me.
Yeah, that's a fact, man. That's a fact. Well, why don't we start this podcast like we always start this? Why don't you tell everybody about where you live and what do you do for a living?
Sure. I currently live in Pike County, Illinois, in a small town of Pittsfield. I've been here 3 years. Actually, it was 3 years ago, May 1st. And I am the marketing director, oversee all creative video production, marketing assets, branding, things like that for Whitetail Properties.
Nice. Nice. So let me ask you this, because everybody in the world wants to, you know, if they love hunting or they want to get into the hunting industry, feels like, man, I want to be the director of marketing for some company. You know, that just sounds like a fun job. How did you get into that position with Whitetail Properties?
Before that, I was the marketing manager for Scentlock, and basically getting into the industry was kind of an interesting thing for me, because I didn't know anybody. I wasn't related to anybody or had any connections or anything like that. I just knew from a very early age, early high school, that it was something that I wanted to do in any way I could, you know. And I think that really stems back to kind of my parents' mentorship. You know, they said, you have to work for the majority of your life, make it something you really enjoy doing. And that really stuck to me. That really rang true. And so, kind of a long story short, the only way I knew how to do that was to just basically cold call companies. So I made a list of companies and just started calling them in the afternoons, and finally got through to a couple, and kind of through different conversations and stuff, I was kind of like, found out that, you know, my whole initial approach was internships. Like, can I find summer work or internships or anything like that? And my whole thing was I was willing to do it for free. I was willing to do it for no pay, just the experience. Like, that's how, like, just absolutely, you know, enamored and just on fire for it I was. And finally, you know, just, I guess just by luck, through the grace of God, it was actually Scentlock who kind of gave me my first conversation. And, come to find out, a couple of these companies were interested to talk about internships, but they only really offered them to college students. And I was 15 at the time. So, they were kind of like, I'll never forget. I had a conversation with Brad Shore at Realtree one time. He was like, I was like, hey, I'm just looking to kind of get my foot in the door, willing to do anything really. And, you know, I've got a passion for writing and just in business and things like that. And I just want to try to learn as much as I can. And he goes, oh, you know, what year are you? And I was like, oh, I'm a sophomore. And he's like, oh, what's your major? What degree are you going for? And I was just kind of like, graduating? Like, I just didn't have a good answer. And he's like, well, how old are you? And I was like, well, I'm 15. And I think I might have been 16 at the time. And he's like, holy cow, you know, you're 16 and you're getting a, you know, it's awesome that you got on the ball. And so through a couple similar, I found out, I was like, well, okay, understanding that internships or part-time work are really available to college students or kind of up, what, you know, I started asking, what are the things you guys typically look for in skill sets or experience or, you know, degrees, whatever. And the two most consistent answers I got were, you know, business, like some type of sales or marketing in business, and writing, having strong writing skills. So, I kind of already had a knack or an interest in writing as it was. So I knew that was something I really wanted to kind of continue to evolve and grow and adapt. And then I enjoyed marketing too. So it was kind of a natural fit as it was. And so I went to college, and it was a small D3 college in Michigan, and went to play baseball and focused on writing, journalism, and business communications. And so once I finally got to college and got my foot in the door, I was a little more systematic. I made my entire list of companies that I had phone numbers for or maybe even contacts for now. And then one Friday, I would spend one Friday afternoon each month and call that entire list. And it was probably 50 to 60 companies on it. And after a while, it was a lot of like, oh, we don't have anything right now, but, you know, keep trying back, or thanks for calling and think of us, you know. Well, after about 3 or 4 months, it kind of started to be, oh, hey, Alex, how's it going? How's baseball going? Okay, yeah, well, nothing yet, but, you know, try back and stay in touch. And then sure enough, Scentlock gave me an opportunity for a summer internship my junior year. And I made the most of that opportunity and kind of just took off from there. And then ended up into, you know, still went and did some camera work and some production work for some hunting shows. And then actually ended up about 2 years after I graduated college, I got an opportunity to come join Scentlock's marketing team as a full-time position. And the kind of the rest is history. I spent 6 years there and absolutely loved it, and loved the people there, and loved getting to manufacture goods and getting to market goods and really get to learn ins and outs of that entire business. And through the hunting clothing side of things, Whitetail Properties has, you know, produces a television show, and Scentlock worked with Whitetail Properties on that. And I got to know Paul Sawyer and Dan Perez, two of the founding fathers, kind of the partners of Whitetail Properties, through that. And they ended up calling me a little over 3 years ago now and said, hey, we'd be really interested in you coming down and kind of taking the helm of our creative and our video production and our marketing. And I was like, well, you know, I love Michigan. I've had a really good run at Scentlock and kind of feel like there's some new things here for me, and getting the chance to move and put down roots in Pike County, Illinois, didn't sound too bad either.
Yeah. Wow. That's awesome. Now, a lot of college guys, and myself was included, you leave high school, you go to college, and you have no idea what you wanted to do, right? I went in there and I was just like, what do I want to do when I grow up? I don't know. And I really didn't know that until, man, my late 20s. But it sounds like you had, and you knew what you wanted to do. You knew what, industry you wanted to work in. You went to college to accomplish that goal to get into one of these companies.
That's exactly right. And honestly, it's something I hate to say I took it for granted, but it's something I just wasn't aware of probably until the last few years, where I really was like, man, like, it was really kind of a blessing to have, you know, by no means that I have it figured out, but to have a course and then really try to execute it. You know, I just, it is, you're exactly right, man. I mean, a lot of people, and, you know, my brother's really close, you know, I'm really close to my brother, and he's in that boat too. You know, he's in his upper 20s and still doesn't really know, you know, he's got a job to pay the bills and do his thing. But it's like, you know, and I think that's one of the things, like even the guys I manage, you know, at Whitetail on the creative side, is I get so fired up and I get so excited to like try to help people realize their passion and then go do that. Like do that for a living. And I mean, like I said, I mean, like my parents' words just really rung true to me that you spend the majority of your life working, man, like do something you love to do. Don't wake up every day feeling like you got to go to work and grind through that, because it's just, there's just so much more to it. I mean, and I'm so blessed and lucky. I can honestly say, like, don't get me wrong, there's days, right? But it's like, I can honestly say I wake up and feel like I really don't have to go to work every day.
Yeah. That's a good thing, man. And I'm kind of in that position now where, doing this podcast and doing the content through the Sportsman's Nation and Nine Fingers, that is, it doesn't feel like work. It's my job now, because I kind of got forced into it through a layoff.
Right.
But like this conversation I'm having with you is awesome. Like, who doesn't want to talk about, you know, the outdoors right. all day long?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I mean, and you and I, you know, talked a little bit over the years and stuff, and I knew it was kind of one of those things where, like, talking to you about, man, like, when's the time right? Like, when can I make this transition? When can I make this switch? And I was like, my first, I was actually talking to Kenny about, he said, like, oh man, like, you know, the other day, whatever, Johnson got laid off. And I was like, my very first reaction was like, awesome. Like, I don't want him to be like, you know, his family to be in like financial turmoil or anything like that. Right. But like, I knew where your heart was, and I knew you would, with the opportunity and being, like you said, forced to do this, I knew you would kill it. And I know that's what you want to do. And I was pumped for you. I really was. Like, deep down, I was like, man, he's going to rock it.
Right. It was kind of, it's funny. I don't know if I've shared this story on this podcast, but they brought me and a handful of people into a room, and it was a big cut, you know, across the entire company. And they said, okay, well, today is your last day here. And
wow,
the first thing that I thought of was, cool, I can fit another podcast in this afternoon. So it was like, yeah, it was bad from the financial standpoint, but it was good because now I can just grind on what I'm passionate about.
Yeah. And just be happy, man. Absolutely. That's the thing. Like, just be happy. And that's what I tell everybody, is like, life is too short, and it's just do what you love and be happy with it. And I mean, it's, money isn't everything. Obviously, we all got responsibilities, and you've got kids and all this other stuff, but it's yeah, just be happy. And I'm pumped that you get an opportunity to do that now.
Absolutely. All right, we're going to take a little hard transition here, and I want to kind of take a step back all the way to the beginning, and I want you to talk a little bit about your introduction into the outdoors. I mean, stuff like, did you come from a hunting family or an outdoors family? Is this something that you kind of picked up later on, or just kind of lay that down for us?
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely was lucky enough to grow up in a hunting family. My dad, you know, is a good hunter, loves to hunt, really enjoys it. And it was one of those things that I think the anticipation and the buildup due to like Michigan's laws, I grew up in Southwest Michigan. It was, you could archery hunt deer when you were 12 and small game hunt with a gun when you were 12, but you couldn't hunt deer with a gun until you were 14. And that was kind of like when I was probably until the time I was like 9 or 10, that was all I really knew, because my dad wasn't a bow hunter. He was a Michigan gun hunter.
Yeah.
And so that was like, man, I can't wait till I'm 14. Right. Well, going through hunter safety when I was like 10 or 11, no, I think I was 11. Man, heck, I might even be 12. Going through hunter safety right before, you know, in the spring, early summer. And then I was like, started like understanding all the laws and regulations. And I was like, wait a second, like, I can deer hunt when I'm 12 with a bow. Like, I'm going to get a bow. Like, I'm going to do that. That sounds incredible. Like, I don't have to wait 2 more years to deer hunt. This is awesome. You know? So, and I had, in addition to my dad, my uncle who really wasn't a big, actually my uncle on my mom's side, who really wasn't a big hunter himself, but just, he was so selfless and so like giving of his time and his energy to my brothers and my brother and me. And, and And just really loved to see us happy and do the stuff we love to do, whether it be fishing, hunting, whatever. And he was like, all right, so he got me my first bow, for Christmas. And I was started shooting the thing all the time. And it just grew on fire and just absolutely just grew a passion for archery and for deer hunting. And it just kind of like snowballed from there. And I shot my first, animal when I was 12, my first game animal when I was 12 was a rabbit with my dad. And it was special. I remember like it was yesterday. And it just continued to do really cool stuff from there. And just really continued to pursue bow hunting and try to understand deer hunting. I mean, you know, everybody called me the sponge. I watched every video, every DVD I could ever, actually, hell, it was VHS back then. Right. Like, right. I mean, it was VHS tapes and read every article and just crazy stuff. I just wanted to learn as much information as I could about this bow hunting thing. And then it was really probably one of the most fun things looking back on it was my dad ended up getting a bow and like found archery through my passion for it. So it was so cool to see that come full circle, for him. And now, I mean, neither, I don't think either one of us has carried a gun into the deer woods in like 7 years or so. Not that we have anything against it. It's just like, we would rather be bow hunting. So, yeah. So that's kind of a long story short on really how my passion for archery really kind of started. And I think through that, obviously being different seasons earlier in the year, longer seasons than just firearm season, I was kind of doing that on my own. So I kind of had to figure out a lot on my own. I mean, my dad definitely taught me the basics and he really gave me some really good values and lessons learned about deer in general. But when it came to like understanding how to get within archery range of deer, I really took another step to a different level for me. And I really kind of just continued to just get more on fire and get deeper into the passion for it. And that was at the time, I mean, I was coming up in a time frame where like hunting shows and DVDs really started getting popular. Yeah. The outdoor networks weren't quite there yet, but so, you know, I don't regret it or look at it as a negative or anything like that, but I was so enamored with them. Like I was like, I can't believe that these guys get paid, you know, at the time, obviously now being in the industry and understanding how it works. But at the time, it's like, I can't believe these guys get paid to shoot deer on camera. And that's their job. Like it just absolutely blew my mind. I was like, I have to do this. I have to. And so started understanding about, you know, cameras, took the little family handy cam out and just doing stuff and just kind of filming whatever I could and just having a ball. Well, what that led to was like, I started passing deer, like, and I know you kind of have a little bit of a similar story. It's like, I started like passing deer that like I had no business passing when I was 12 and 13 years old. And I'd say, luckily I had, like, when I was 12 and 13, those first couple of years, I mean, I was flinging arrows at anything, like anything that was a deer that was in range. I was sending them. I missed six deer with a bow before I ever killed one. Yeah. So it was like, I just couldn't figure it out. I was, you know, and then finally could overcome that, you know, the buck fever and just the emotions and adrenaline. But yeah, I mean, it was crazy. You know, now it's like, I really love to target and hunt mature deer and try to do that on, you know, public land, do it myself, whatever. But it was kind of coming up into it at a time when that stuff was really getting popular, and it really kind of shaped and changed. Like I said, I don't really know if it's a good thing or a bad thing today, but it's kind of what it is and what it was. That's kind of the path I took.
Yeah. And I tell you, that's in some way, shape and form, it's similar to my story, because like, although I didn't necessarily grow up in a hunting family, like my two uncles, they didn't live near me per se, like they were 2 hours away from me. So as I was growing up, they kind of, they were doing their thing, but I didn't necessarily grow up in a hunting family. I kind of found archery or hunting later. And what I mean by that is, yeah, I started hunting at about, you know, 13, 14 years old, not seriously. And I had no mentorship as far as what you should or shouldn't be doing. So it was all like hard knocks type of learning as far as hunting whitetails was concerned. But I do have this one memory of me getting like my first trail camera, and it was this big like film trail camera, right? Where
with like the D batteries,
right? D batteries. It probably weighed, I feel like it weighed 10 pounds, right?
Right. Right.
You put it on the tree and you're getting whatever walks by, you know. It's not today where you get thousands of pictures on an SD card. I was getting 24 pictures. And if those 24 pictures all happened in the second that I left, then there's 2 weeks there that go by with nothing. Well, anyway, you know, I go and I get this picture developed, or these pictures developed, and I'm like, oh my God, it's a buck. And it's like this 120 inch deer. Right. And I get excited because I had yet to see a, number one, I had yet to shoot a deer. And number two, I had yet to, see a buck on trail camera. So I get this 120 inch buck, you know, maybe a, I don't know if it was a 10 pointer or an 8 pointer or a 9 pointer or whatever. It's just like a 2 year old, right? In Iowa. And I take it to the farmer whose land I was on. I was like, oh, check this out. Look at this buck. And he goes, yeah, what about it? And he was, he wasn't fired up about it at all. And I'm like, what? This is a big buck. He's like, son, like, no, it's not. Don't shoot that deer. You know, shoot one of the bigger ones. And I'm just, I didn't get it. So I get this education from this farmer who's like, there's bigger deer out there. So before I even shot a deer or a buck with a bow, I was passing deer, which if I look back on it, I think I should have shot more deer and did the brown it's down thing for a while and not instantly go into, like, I don't know, QDM practices. You know what I mean?
Right. Oh yeah, dude. And that's your exact, I get it completely. And yeah, that's tough. I mean, like you said, because you didn't have any of that kind of guidance. And I mean, and I guess I did. I probably had 2 years, probably my first 2 years where it was kind of brown it's down and I was letting it fly and I killed a couple deer and it was great. But it was a short process. It was a short transition for me. You know, it was right from there into that. But yeah, I mean, it's just hard to say. Like I said, can't have any regrets, and you're in a happy place now. You know, you love doing what you do, but I get where you're coming from for sure. Where it's like letting the air out a couple more of them early on probably would have changed things a little bit.
Right. But the good thing about this whole thing was, they say in order to kill big deer, you have to be comfortable around big deer, right? So I started passing these little deer, which meant I'm in the woods more, which means I'm getting these interactions with these bigger deer. I'm becoming more comfortable around them. I'm making less mistakes because, you know, I let a 140 inch deer walk by when I was 20 some years old, and that allowed me to not get fired up, not make mistakes, not shoot a younger deer when I'm after a bigger deer, whatever. And so my question to you is, how old were you when you started taking that next step into, hey man, I really only want to target mature deer?
I killed my first big mature deer when I was 16. And then the next year I shot a 2 year old, a nice deer. I mean, again, growing up in Southwest Michigan, and I say big mature, I mean, he's 140 inch nine pointer. When I was 16, I mean, it was, you know, it's what we call a giant. I mean, you just don't see many deer like that around in Michigan. I mean, you know how pressured it can be and just how small the tracks are. But anyway, the next year I killed a 2 year old, and I wasn't disappointed with the deer. I was happy that I was happy with everything, but thinking back on it after it had happened, I was kind of like, this is okay, but this feeling is way different than the feeling I got last year when I shot that big deer.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I want more of that. I need more of that. So, and I'm, you know, filling the freezer, it to me is priority one. I get that right first and foremost right off the bat. I mean, I want meat for the freezer, organic, good red venison that I can just eat all year long. I mean, that's what I'm happiest for sure. So shooting does and shooting, you know, it's very, very important. And I don't have anything at all against shooting younger deer. I just started realizing and then it gets into what we talk about all the time, right? Like the chess match. And it's like, okay, if you're making the decision to start pursuing mature deer, then all the other stuff has to happen. You got to learn in woodsmanship, and you got to learn how they operate, where they live, how they travel, transition, where they, you know, what the process is. And that's when it just reached a whole nother level. So I would say late teens, early 20s. And to your point, I agree with that statement so much that you said about, and I really truly believe to consistently kill big deer, you have to learn to be comfortable around big deer. And And for me, that was filming. When I was in my early 20s and I was filming for a couple different shows and stuff like that, and I was filming guys who were passing gear that I would have never passed in a million years, you know, like good 3-year-olds, you know, even big giant 2-year-olds, good 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, stuff like that. They just weren't what they were looking for. It taught me in a hurry, like how they move through the woods, how they transition, how they look, how they listen. And it just, I learned so much in such a short amount of time, but through filming, that it was like, man, like just awesome lessons learned to kind of even fast track being able to be around big deer and knowing what I need to do.
Right. Right. So for me, and this is going to turn into a question for you, but for me,
okay,
I made a lot of mistakes in that time frame, not just year one, but a ton of mistakes when I made the decision to start targeting, you know, mature bucks. What were some of the biggest mistakes that you can remember making, you know, that you were able to learn from when you started that switch of that target?
Number one, hands down, was patience. Just didn't have it. I don't in general, like in general life, I don't have much patience. But hunting is one of those things that I've thankfully and just really, really thankful to be able to have learned and you know, wrap my arms around patience when it comes to hunting. I really need to probably do that in other areas of my life, but that was number one for sure. Was knowing when to push in, when to hold back, knowing, you know, when to not call to a deer or to call to a deer, knowing, you know, when to wait to get a better shot or wait to, you know, just move a setup. Or it was just understanding those dynamics of like, okay, you need to just be patient and time it right. That was probably the number one thing for me, where I just would go in and get so overly aggressive. And I was, you know, at that time, gosh, it was Dan Infault's early days as far as like hunting media. And he's been a huge mentor of mine just through his media and things like that. He grows and you know, he kind of cut his teeth hunting swamps. That's a lot of what we had around our areas and in the properties that I hunted was a lot of swamp and marsh stuff. So it just really related well, just diving off in there and getting after it, you know, it was making tons of mistakes and learning along the way. But I would have to say that, yeah, that patience was probably the number one thing. I would just not be patient enough.
So you hear this a lot, right? So people don't have patience, but at the same time, we have these conversations and we hear these stories about guys saying, you know, you got to have patience, but you have to also know when to be aggressive. So do you feel that your lack of patience allowed your learning curve to become shortened because you were diving in and being ultra aggressive on, you know, some of these sets and making the mistakes that you made?
Absolutely. For sure. Yep. It was, and my dad was fortunate enough to kill some really nice deer, and it's been awesome to see that, but it wasn't the caliber of the deer that I really necessarily wanted, or I'd even seen a couple times, you know, where I'd gone into bedding areas you're not quote unquote supposed to go into, or you're not supposed to do this. And some of the deer that I'd just seen at a distance, I was like, oh my gosh, like we don't have anything like that on our wall. You know, we've never seen anything like that. Like, I want to try to get, how do I make this happen? And so I agree. Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, dude, I'm still screwing up left and right, and I got tons to learn, but it definitely put me in the game, quote unquote, with bigger, more mature deer a lot, I guess, sooner, because I almost did it backwards, where I didn't have to force myself to really push the envelope and get in and be aggressive. I kind of reverse engineered that, if you will, where it was like, all right, I'm getting too aggressive, and now I gotta tone it back and scale back a little bit.
So you almost did it opposite of what a majority of the people do, and they are too patient and they wait too long and miss an opportunity.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's just a lot of times it's about the property you're hunting and the type of hunting that's around your area and just what that kind of allows. But yeah, I mean, to put it as simply as possible, I would agree with that. Yeah. That it kind of allowed me to kind of do that a little bit backwards.
Yeah. All right. So, you know, you had to force yourself to learn some patience. As you started kind of changing your methodology on how you're approaching these mature deer, did that patience pay off, or did you have to find like a good balance between the patience and being aggressive?
I think it paid off. You know, I think it was finding that good mixture, that good balance. And I think where it probably helped me the most was I'm a big like consistency guy. Like, what conditions or what elements are in place that you've seen mature deer on their feet in daylight? Like, what are the consistencies? Now, granted, you know, the rut can be crazy and deer can just be everywhere at all different times of day and weather and fronts and all this other stuff. But I just, that's probably like another big thing I attribute to patience, was just being really observant, like really just trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together, be observant, figure out, okay, like when, you know, the temperature drops this many degrees on average, you know, you've seen a lot more deer in these 2 weeks year over year than you do other times. Like, there's might be something to that. So I'm always trying to draw correlations and connect dots and things like that from an observation standpoint and movement pattern standpoint. And I mean, gosh, it isn't even region to region. It's almost property to property that can be different based on different things and elements. But that's probably one of the big things that I really spend a lot of time on, is trying to understand the correlations to movement and what the conditions and what the elements are, and being able to almost, you know, try to, you know, never get it right all the time, but you try to forecast or plan or predict
right
certain things based on, you know, what past experiences have been.
Right. So with all that said, then, do you feel that you're more of a data-driven hunter or go with your gut style?
For some reason, I want to be more data driven, but I'm definitely a gut guy. Like, it's like, it's just, it comes down to it. And it's like, that is, there's a big deer in there. There's a big deer living in there, and I know I need to get in there. So I'm going to go get him, or I'm going to go at least try to see him. Now, granted, I will definitely do everything in my power to get like data driven, like around that. But, and I also spend like an insane, I was actually talking with a buddy about this not too long ago. I think if I had to add the hours up, I bet I spend just as much time postseason scouting or scouting in the off season, than I do actually hunting.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I really had to compare it. So, again, I want to understand consistencies. I want to understand like trends in their movement patterns, how they make sign, I want to learn as much as I possibly can about mature deer in different situations and what can be the same or what to look for. And I just really pour into that as much as possible. But that being said, I just feel like you got to go with your gut at the end of the day, you know, and even though you might make a mistake or might make the wrong move, I feel like there's a lot more that can come out of that than it's almost like, you know, one of the sayings that hunters say a lot is like paralysis by analysis. It's like, I think if you just analyze too much or get too crazy with the data or information, you're never going to make a move, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that can definitely be a negative.
Yeah. And I tell you what, I find myself doing more prep work these last couple seasons than actually hunting itself. And I think that's a mixture of things. And what I mean by that is, one, I'm forced to hunt less because I have too many kids. You know, I got a wife and I have these other responsibilities that I have to take care of. So the days of hunting, you know, October 1, 5 days in a row are over, right? So I have to pick and choose, especially if I'm, you know, wanting to go on an elk hunt or a mule deer hunt, right? I'm leaving the state. So I gotta spend more time at home. And that, I think what that does is that not only reduces the pressure on the properties that I hunt, but at the same time, it makes me really think hard about the decisions that I make, because I don't want to make any more mistakes.
Could not agree more, man. I mean, I'm actually getting married this August, but so the family thing is on the horizon, but
right.
don't have kids yet, but man, with work and everything, like, it's so time, you know, time demanding, and you want to make the most of your time. Like, a really big buzzword for me is efficiency. Like, I have to be efficient, and I want to be efficient. Last year was the most efficient year I've ever had in my life. It was almost silly how efficient it was. And I think it was just probably a lot of luck more than anything, but it was, you know, it's like, if I'm going out of state and I've got, you know, 5 or 6 or, you know, maybe even 10 on a long trip or whatever days to get it done, it's like, you have to be efficient with your time. You've got to run, you know, you've got to scout on the go and put the stand on your back and really, like you said, just try to analyze and process information and what you're seeing as quickly as possible, because you just don't have that much time.
Right. Right. So let me ask you this. You moved away from Michigan and, you know, now you're somewhere. Like, what was your first move outside of Michigan?
I actually moved to Iowa.
Okay. Iowa.
I moved to Albia, Iowa, and was an intern for Bill Winkie at Midwest Whitetail.
Okay. So when you're there, obviously you have a lot of responsibilities, you know, during the hunting season there, but did your goal change from moving from Michigan to Iowa? I mean, what was that change like for you?
Yeah. I would say definitely, you know, I was still fairly realistic. It's like, okay, man, like, you've been able to put some decent bucks on the ground, you know, some really, really, really good Michigan deer, and heck, good for anywhere. I think it's always all about the, you know, that deer is that, you know, quality of that deer is measured by the happiness and the gratification that the hunter has, I think, you know. So I was very happy with them, but yeah, certainly. I mean, it's like, you're in Southeast Iowa, right? I mean, it's the land of the giants, and of course there's going to be a 180 that steps around the next tree, and you know, and that's what you're looking for. So it's like, yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. So I, you know, I was still realist. I was pretty much, my goals, I guess, or what I was kind of at was like, you know, I really, really want to be able to, you know, target 4-year-olds, you know, and I was hunting on public ground, then, and I mean, still hunt majority of public ground today, but it's, you know, it's kind of even evolved now that I've been doing it a little longer, but in those first couple of years out of state and being in a quote unquote big buck state, it was like, all right, if it's a, you know, a heck of a 3-year-old, I'm probably not going to lay off. And if it, you know, if it's a 4-year-old good mature buck, you know, shoot her. So that was kind of my mindset.
Yeah. So how did those first couple seasons in Iowa go for you?
Really humbling.
Yeah.
I had lucked out. I call them a huge success because, you know, my main responsibility was to film. Like, it wasn't to hunt. So I got very little hunting time, actually. I had seen the biggest typical, when I was on, you know, on stand myself and had a couple days I could get out on public ground. I saw the biggest typical I'd ever seen. I mean, it was a deer well over 180 as a clean 10. And just to see an animal like that was just unbelievable and just incredibly great. But it was probably, I guess, I started going to Kansas around that same time. I guess it was the next year. For a period of time and hunting some public and walking stuff there and got it done on a good 8-pointer. But it was, I would say overall my growth or progression as far as like killing, you know, higher caliber deer, like in those quote unquote big buck states where, you know, on public ground, where it's a little bit harder to do it. It was what I would classify as probably a slow progression. I mean, it wasn't like, oh, I'm moving out of state and I'm just going to start, you know, I start just hammering these things. But, I really attribute a lot of like Michigan being so tough, you know, and just the hunting pressure and everything like that so consistently throughout the year. Because I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions too. In these quote unquote big buck states, Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, you know, Nebraska, all this stuff. It's, there's hunting pressure there. You know, it may not be as year as season long as it is in other places, but there's just more people and more hunters. But man, like, you go to the rut, you go in the rut to Iowa, Kansas, whatever, and you're out in public ground, you're gusty. I mean, you might be able to get away from them, but they're getting pressure. So it definitely is not no walk in the park by any means.
Yeah. And I don't know about Michigan or Kansas, but I can speak on Iowa. Iowa, if not the least amount, it's the second or third least amount of public access hunting land in the entire United States. So what that means,
yeah,
is, yes, we have big bucks and we have less hunters, but we also have less public land, which means that there's going to be just as high of a concentration of guys hunting that public land as there is, you know, I'm not going to say it's comparable to, you know, some of these higher density areas in Michigan or Pennsylvania, but we are going to get, you know, whenever I hunt public land, I'm running into a guy or two. If I don't, I got lucky that day. Right. But you know, I'm not good. And yeah, I think that public land gets hammered, but what makes Iowa such a destination is because of all the private ground. There's always that 150 hanging out. And during the rut, you know, big bucks can travel for a long ways and you can get lucky.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's a special place for sure. And I agree with you. I think that the opportunities are definitely there. I mean, regardless of pressure or whatever, it has the opportunity. And that's, I mean, Don Kiske always said from day one, he's like, if you want to kill big deer, you got to hunt where big deer live or deer are, you know, where there are big deer. And that's fact. You know, you got odds and percentages and hunt where there is a higher likelihood or a good likelihood of them being, you know, and it's, you know, big deer's eye in the eye of the beholder, of course, but absolutely, you know, what a deer that you personally want to target or a caliber of deer that you want to target, you need to hunt where those deer exist.
Yes. That's a fact, Jack. All right. So as you know, now you're in the glory, right? The glory land, the holy land of Iowa. How many years did you stick around Iowa before you ended up making it over to Illinois?
It was one.
One.
And yeah, it was 1 year. And then I got actually an opportunity, to move over and film for Whitetail Properties. At the time, and this was in 2011. So I started filming for Whitetail Properties, and that's where I really was able to be blessed and spend an entire season around a lot of guys that passed a lot of what I considered really big deer, and just learned to really be around big deer. And so, I went back home to Michigan and shot a doe that year, but I did not have any other opportunities then because I was filming so much. But you know, I got to I filmed a guy kill 175 inch typical 12 point, and you know, 150 inch 8 point. I mean, it was just some incredible experiences, and just learned and got to enjoy so much of that. And actually that was when I think like, man, I don't know if, you know, being a field producer is really for me. It's fun, I enjoy it, but you know, I kind of still got this kind of in the back of mind, this passion, this driving force for business, and to have a really good understanding of that. So after the 2011, it was toward the end of 2011, that's when Scentlock actually called me back and said, hey, we've got full-time marketing position available. Would you be interested in moving back to Michigan, coming to work for us full-time? And, you know, luckily it was the stars aligned for me to be able to do that and kind of go and experience that. And it was the right time for me. And obviously, like, I think now it's like, man, you moved away from Iowa and Illinois, like, to go back to Michigan. You're like, are you sure about this? But it was absolutely the best decision, and really kind of really put my career kind of on the track that I wanted it to be.
Right. Right. So let me ask you this. How old are you right now?
31.
You're 31. Okay. So, you know, in 2011, you're still a pup. Right. And
that's right. Oh, yeah.
You know, so you definitely, it's not like you're like in your golden years and you had to make these really important decisions. I mean, that sounded for a kid your age at the time, back in 2011, it sounded like a really good opportunity.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, no question. It was an awesome opportunity, and blessed to have it for sure. And I don't take it for granted one second. I mean, I'm so thankful for having that kind of first, hey, let's hire this, you know, like, a better term, this kid, to come up and join our team and really, you know, see what he can do for us. So it was really, really cool opportunity.
Gotcha. So how much did it suck, right? Living, you know, like tasting and seeing what the potential out there is in Illinois and Iowa for big bucks, and then having to move back and, you know, back to hunting Michigan again. Did it give you a different perspective or allow you to look at that higher pressured state in a different way?
It definitely helped me it in a different way. And again, it's all in the eye of the beholder. You know, shooting a good deer in Michigan, I love it, and I get the same rush that I do other times. But I'll sum it up for you this way. So I moved back to Michigan. I think early April rolls around. It's time I need to get my preference point for Iowa, because when I was in Iowa, I was able to find some pretty dang good public spots. So I was like, okay, it's in a couple different units. So I'm like, I'm going to start getting my points, and then in a couple years I'll be able to go. I go on online to get my preference point. It still has me listed as an Iowa resident.
Bingo.
So I'm like, oh man, like what in the world? And so it was the right thing to do. I had to do it. I called the DNR and I was like, I can't believe I'm doing this, but I am, because you can't be a dual resident, right? And you cannot be a dual resident and get resident tax in Iowa. You can't in Michigan either. So I was like, I am no longer an Iowa resident. I am a Michigan resident, moved back for a job. I need to be taken off the list so I can get my preference point. And there's like, I was talking to this gal, there's this long pause. And she
crickets.
Goes, she goes, that's a first. She's like, I've never had anybody tell me they need to be taken off the residency list for their deer licenses in Iowa. It was like, oh man, it was so, it was the right thing to do. And I mean, yeah. it was funny, but man, it was, so that tells you how struggling that was. It was not easy by any means to have to do that.
Right. All right. So I want to hear a kick-ass story from you, whether that is fishing or turkey or bow hunting or whatever. I want you to tell me a story right now about one of the most memorable or exciting hunts that you've ever been on.
Oh boy. Whew. There's a pile of them. But, you know, the one that just comes to the forefront of my mind first, more than anything, was, giving back my dad is a huge thing that's really important to me. And just, I guess, family members or mentors in my, that have really done a lot for me over the years. I really feel this just really deep desire and passion to be able to give back to them. And through being in the industry and meeting some really great people and making a lot of friends and a lot of, you know, connections and relationships, Dad always says, like, ever since he started bow hunting when I was like around 12, you know, kind of years, his whole thing was like, he would love to shoot a bull elk with a bow. Like that's it. Right. Like that's his thing. So I'm kind of, you know, figuring out how in the world I would ever be able to afford something like that, or how would I be able to make that happen or whatever. Well, had some really good friends that were actually in the industry, and they've been going out to Wyoming, on a do-it-yourself public land hunt for a few years now. And I was like, and they actually invited me along. Like, hey man, you got to come try Wyoming for it. You just need one point. You put in your form here point this year and get and draw next year. And I was like, you guys, thank you so much for inviting me. That's incredible. I said, got a favor. I said, is there any way like I could come, but is there any way my dad could tag, like, and I could bring my dad? And they're like, absolutely, for sure. Like, bring him on. It'd be awesome. You know? So we kind of worked the whole thing out, and I surprised. His birthday's in July, and I surprised him with his elk tag. I put a point in from the year before. A year goes by, and I said, you know, and I was kind of like, hey, don't make any vacation plans. I got something going. And he's like, okay. And so, surprised him on his birthday with his elk tag, and just, I mean, it was already like lost it. You know, we were both like just so excited already off the bat.
Yeah.
And ended up, you know, going out to Wyoming with these guys, and it was like the end of the second day, and we had one close call on a setup. Heard a bunch of bulls bugling, worked our tails off already. And like the beginning of the third day, Dad was already like, the trip's made. He's like, this has been the most unbelievable experience. Like here, like hunting in the mountains. He'd never been able to do that before. Just getting to experience like the scenery, the bugling elk, seeing elk at a distance, seeing even some elk close up, like just unbelievable. Either one of us asked for. And sure enough, you know, long story short, that it was the fourth afternoon. We were set up in this like little meadow, that kind of dumped down off these two peaks. It was in this little valley, and it was this open meadow with a stream coming through it. And it was kind of a little opening. There's elk tracks everywhere. There was a bunch of sign there. We were kind of off of it in dark timber, and just cow calling every once in a while. And, And then, you know, sure enough, a bugle just rips off the top of one of these peaks. And it's like, I mean, neither one of us has elk hunted before. I can't bugle to save my life. So I'm just like sitting there, like, you know, a little hoochie mama push button call and like, you know, just trying to do my best here. And thankfully, like through these buddies that I had, like they kind of were like, hey, like this region, like, you know, hunt this section for today. Like there's, you know, we've seen some elk in here. You know, we had a guy 5 or 6 years ago shoot one up in here, just go try. Like, so it was thankfully, man, I mean, it wasn't, we were going to find, like, you know, we had had a lot of really great guidance and help up to that point anyway. So we were still like doing it on our own. It was still public hunting and everything like that. And we were seeing some other people and stuff, but we at least had somebody to point us in the right general direction. And so we kind of get up there. And so again, this bull rips off, like I said, comes down. And man, like, I know you've elk hunted before, like, and I know you know how hard it is and like how just crazy this whole thing is, but it's like, it blew my mind how loud they are. Oh, they're like so crazy loud, like just walking. And so we had this group of cows literally come like 10 feet behind us. And we're just like leaned up against these trees and looking out of the corner of our eyes. And it's just like, it's so unbelievable. I mean, literally I can hear this cow breathing. And thankfully, like it was getting to the evening time. We had the thermals in our advantage and we had the wind in our advantage. So it was like really kind of a lucky thing. So they didn't bust us. They just kind of walked right on past us at like the closest distance ever. And as luck would have it, I was really nervous because I thought the bull, if it was going to come and follow these cows, was going to take the same path. Well, he ends up like, I just see dust kind of coming into this meadow from like off to our left. And I'm looking, trying to look up. And all of a sudden I just see the tips of these tines, the tips of this rack coming down through there. And I mean, it was a 6x5, not a giant by any stretch of the imagination, but an absolute giant to us. I mean, you know, two Michigan freaking whitetail hunters, you know, I mean, it was just like, oh my God. So I'm like, Dad, get up. It's a bull. And so he's like more comfortable shooting standing than he was sitting or anything like that. So he got stood up and sure enough, the bull is like still coming down. He's kind of heading down towards his stream. And we're looking, and I'm trying to range. I'm over my dad's shoulder the whole time, and I'm sitting there ranging. I'm like, gosh, I can't get a range because it's too thick. And finally, his nose kind of comes out of the thing, and I range his nose at like 50. And he's kind of angling at us a little bit, and he actually turns a little bit more toward the end. And I was like, oh, no, don't, like, walk. Please don't walk at us. And, like, he kind of turns and then kind of pivots back down the hill a little bit. And I range him again. He's at 35 yards, like, just slightly quartering away. And I just go with my mouth. I mean, I don't even know why I did my mouth. I just went, like, like that, just like a little cow mute, and he just stopped on a dime. And my dad is already at full draw. He could not have walked up to that elk and stuck the arrow in a better spot. I mean, as soon drilled as the it. Arrow, oh my gosh, absolutely best shot of his life ever that he's made. And my dad's a good shot. Like, he's one of those guys, and I know you know this. Like, it's like, or you know guys like this. It's like he in a paper plate on a target, he would certainly fit in a paper plate, but there would not be a tight group. Like, right. You know, it was that you put a live animal in front of him at 40 yards or closer and it is dead. Like, yeah. That is just the fact of the matter. And that's the same thing. This thing tears off, runs across the creek, runs up on this hill, into the dark timber. We lose sight of him. You can just hear him just as he's jumping stuff. And then he stops. And then it's like somebody rolled a pickup truck down a hill. It's just like this. And I mean, I just can't even begin to describe like the emotions. And I mean, we're sitting there, we're bawling, we're yelling, we're throwing stuff, we're hugging, we're like rolling around the ground. And dad's like, what did we just do? Like, it's kind of like, and he's sitting there shaking, and you know, he's 64 years old. Right. And it's just like, it was, I mean, honest to goodness, the most unbelievable experience I've ever had doing anything, let alone, you know, the outdoors and hunting. And I didn't even have a weapon in my hand, but it was the most incredible thing to help my dad fulfill his bucket list. Like a couple, like I said, you know, flatlander Michigan whitetail hunters that love to just run and gun deer and shoot whitetails, and to just say, hey, we're gonna go do this, you know. And I mean, it, as you know, dude, you've been on elk hunts, it's like hitting the lottery. It just doesn't happen. Like, yeah. you got guys that go years and years and years that never even get an opportunity. And I mean, for us to have that was, I don't know if I'll ever beat it. I don't know if it'll ever be topped.
I tell you what, man, that's an awesome story. And it's a perfect example of how hunting can make memories, even though you're not hunting. You know what I mean?
Oh, man. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. 100% right. I mean, and I think about that now, getting married, and, you know, I've mentored plenty of kids. I've taken a bunch of kids to get their first turkey. I've been blessed enough to take some adults and get their first deer and stuff. And those are some of the memories that just stand out the most to me, because it's like, we know what it means to us, but to actually see people lose physical control of their body due to excitement, it's just like, it's so infectious and so contagious. And it's like, it's what it's about, man. And I'm getting married this August, and thinking about, you know, the family, it's like, I can only imagine, you know, what, you know, you've talked to you about, you know, your daughter's getting older now, and obviously Max getting older now, where it's like, they're, you know, they're going to start going, and you've got to just be so pumped about that, to have those opportunities.
Yeah. I didn't realize how, you know, like, I used to be a really selfish hunter. Like, hey, I'm going to go out by myself. I mean, that's because that's how I was got into hunting. I mean, like I said, I didn't have much of a mentor, so it was all me. And then I started taking my wife turkey hunting, and I get a kick. I just get a kick out of, you know, the strutter comes in, and she's like, it's like, now she's a killer. She's a killer now, but she still gets that excitement of, and then there's her excitement, and then my excitement almost trumps her excitement, because I'm just as jacked that she shot a turkey, and I called it in, and it was like together. That's just, I don't know. And now that my kids are starting to become of age, it's just, now if they could just be quiet, I think that's all I need them to do. And then we can go hunting.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I totally know where you're coming from, man. Cause I cherish my time in the woods so much, and experience, and we do a lot of stuff, like, especially when your job's centered around it. And so it's so important, right? Like, I mean, I'm an outdoor writer. I write quite a few articles every year and things like that for different magazines, different, you know, online forums, stuff like that. And it's like, you almost have to, like, there's like some added pressure, but that time's so special and important that, you know, from half of October through November, it's like, I think about that. I'm like, man, when you have kids, like, you're going to have to take them. And like, and I'm just being honest with you. Like, I don't know how that makes me feel. Like, part of me is like, that's kind of my time to hunt. So I don't know about that, but I'm hoping, sure. I've had enough buddies, you know, and I'm getting old enough now where I've got a bunch of buddies that have kids and stuff. And it's like, dude, the game changes. Like, it's just way different than you can imagine. And so I'm looking forward to that. Not that I don't take kids, obviously, when it's really quote unquote good or whatever, but it's just one of those things. Like, it's almost like a balancing act. And I think if everybody's honest with themselves, they probably experience that to some degree, you know, for everybody. It's like, man, this is my time. Like, I want to go hunt, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I tell you what, man. Alex, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to hop on the podcast and BS with me for a little bit, man. Appreciate it.
You bet, buddy. Anytime. I love it. I love what you're doing. I'm proud to see you get pushed off the ledge, and this is you now. I love it. The old nine fingers is no cubicle life anymore, brother.
It's closet life now, because everything's in a closet. Yeah. So
I love it.
And that brings us to an end of this episode. Huge shout out to Alex Gilstrom for taking time out of his day to hop on the podcast and chit chat with me. Huge shout out to all of you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for making this podcast what it is. Please, if you find this podcast interesting, tell your friends. Please spread the word. Let everybody know that they need to listen to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you download your podcast. Go to social media, chat me, whatever. Make sure you're following the Sportsman's Nation Instagram page. Lots of information going on there. And lastly, a huge shout out to all the partners of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. Lone Wolf, Hunter Safety Systems, Wasp Archery, Ripcord, Ozonics, and Prime. Please go out and support the companies that support this podcast, because without them, now the game has changed, right? This is my job, and I need financial support. And one way to do that is to sell advertising to you guys and make some money straight up. That's how it works. And so please at least go give their products a try. And tell them that Dan Johnson influenced you to buy their products. So, all right, I'm talking out my ass now. please, if you're gonna be in a tree at all, doing some tree stand work, because that time is coming very fast. Our friends at Hunter Safety Systems are reminding us to please wear your damn safety harness. Have a good rest of the week.